So this was called Operation Shamrock, and the way it worked out was the NSA built this phony television tape processing company in New York. It was actually in an office building, made to look like a television tape processing company. And NSA people would go to the rear door of Western Union and these other companies after midnight every night. As per an agreement, the employee would, through the back door, pass all that day's telegrams, which were on all these computer tapes, to the NSA employee, who would take them back to NSA, duplicate them in this place in New York City, and bring the originals back before daybreak, and then send the copies down to Fort Meade for analysis. So it was the largest, probably the largest illegal eavesdropping operation ever created in the United States. And it was a it was very successful. Nobody found out about it until 1975, when the Church Committee discovered it. And as a result of that, it came to an end. And a lot of reforms were created in the intelligence community. One of those reforms was the creation of a very secret court known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Even a lot of lawyers I talked to have never heard of the FISA court. But it's a very interesting thing. It was created in around 1978. And since 1978, it has a unique distinction of never, ever having turned the government down. And if the FISA court does turn the government down, there is what's known as a FISA appeals court, which is sort of the, and the judges that sit on it are sort of the Maytag repairmen of the judiciary. Since they were created in 1978, they have never once heard a case. So so that's one of the reforms that were created after the Church Committee. If the NSA now wants to eavesdrop on what's known as a U.S. person, it has to get a warrant from this this secret court. But to be fair, the Justice Department has looks over these requests before they actually get to the court, and the Justice Department does turn these requests down occasionally. I mean, they have been known to scrutinize these, and the most controversial case came with the recent case involving Zacharias Massawi in Minnesota, because the Justice Department turned down the request for a FISA warrant and never sent it to the FISA court. Just to stay a little bit more on the how NSA affected individual rights in terms of eavesdropping. NSA also had an operation known as Minaret, where they began, Richard Nixon turned NSA inward and began using NSA's advanced technology to spy domestically on U.S. citizens, primarily anti-war protesters. Now, when the agency was created, I mean, it's just to give you an analogy here, when NSA was created, it was created to use against foreign enemies, basically, people overseas and not domestically. For the same reason that we don't give cruise missiles to local state police departments. I mean, they may would like those, but you know, they're not supposed to be used domestically, and we're not supposed to use extremely powerful and somewhat dangerous intelligence agencies domestically. Otherwise, you're going to be creating a Orwellian 1984. So that was why a lot of these reforms were created, and now there's a movement to turn back a number of these reforms. One of the other things I came up with, just before I start moving to the more current day, I found another thing that actually had nothing to do with NSA, so I just don't want to tar NSA with this operation, but I did find it in the course of research on NSA. It was a thing called Project Northwoods. And what happened was, during the 60s, after the failed Bay of Pigs attack, which was where the CIA was sent into Cuba to try to instigate a rebellion and take over Cuba and oust Fidel Castro, it was a total failure. But after that failure, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the senior military people in the country, wanted to go in and take over the country, but this time not do it covertly. They just wanted to send the Army, Navy, and Air Force in to have an overt invasion, just invade the country, take it over, oust or kill Castro, and put in their own leader. So the problem with that scenario, however, is that there was not going to be very much support either within the United States especially the OAS, the Organization of American States, or within our European allies for such an aggressive action against a country that was not at the time doing anything to the United States, wasn't attacking the United States or anything. So Operation Northwoods was to create a justification for this this war against Cuba. And what Operation Northwoods was a roadmap to create terrorism in the United States. The actual document said people will be shot on American streets, bombs will be blown up in New York and Miami, refugee boats from Cuba will be sunk on the high seas. All this to create the impression that this is being done by terrorists from Cuba and to lay out a justification for attacking Cuba. They even had a plan that if John Glenn went into, John Glenn was about to go into space on his very first space mission, actually the very first space mission by the United States. And there was a plan in Operation Northwoods where if the rocket accidentally blew up, they would plant evidence showing that Cuba did it. Cuba sabotaged the rocket and killed Glenn and destroyed the U.S. space program. They also had one other plan that involved flying an unmanned plane that was made to look like a charter plane full of students over Cuba, and then they were broadcast. It was an unmanned plane flown by remote control, but it would have been a full-size airliner. And they would broadcast a message saying that we're being attacked by... It was supposed to fly in the vicinity of Cuba, and the message was going to be, we're being attacked by Cuban missiles or whatever. And a few minutes later, somebody at CIA would have pushed a button and exploded the plane over the ocean, and Cuba would have been blamed for destroying this plane and killing these students. They had one other one that was called Remember the Main Incident Operation. And they were actually talking about blowing up a U.S. Navy ship in Havana Harbor. I mean, these were serious considerations. These were approved by every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, including the chairman. And then it got to Secretary of Defense McNamara, and he rejected it. At least there was one adult in the Pentagon. So all these things lead to public skepticism about what government does. And I only found these documents 40 years after the case, I mean 40 years after the event. And they were only turned out now because of a demand by a group known as the Assassination Records Review Board, which had been set up by Congress to take one final look into the Kennedy assassination. And they had an enormous ability to force Congress to force government agencies to release a lot of documents. And that's the only way these documents got out, otherwise they'd still be secret. Which leads me to say, I kind of wonder 40 years from today what documents we're going to be finding pulled out of the archives or whatever. So today, let me give you a little background and tell you a little bit about NSA today. I'll give you a sort of a thumbnail sketch of the agency, and I'll give you this, you know, in statistics that'll give you a little bit of an idea of the size and what it's like. First of all, it's located halfway between Washington and Baltimore, and it's on a military base known as Fort George Meade. It's an enormous facility. It's so big that the nickname for it is Crypto City, and Crypto City is it's a very large area. There's 50 buildings in there, including a chip manufacturing plant. It's surrounded by three fences, including an electrified middle fence. Then there's anti-truck bomb boulders, these huge boulders around it, then anti-tank devices. And then they have this group known as the Men in Black, which are people dressed in black ninja outfits that come out with Uzi machine guns as sort of a last resort to defend the agency. Once you're inside, it's a very unusual place. Some of the officials have very unusual titles. One of them was Chief of Anonymity. anonymity is one of the foremost ideas, concepts within NSA. If you pick up their security book, that's one of the first things they talk about. Basically, it's keeping NSA's identity quiet. So you don't talk about the fact that you work there, you just don't talk about NSA at all. The newsletters, which are unclassified, but And normally contain very mundane things like what the menu is for next week or whatever in the cafeteria. And they've got a phrase on each one that says, quote, this newsletter should be destroyed as soon as they have been read, or as soon as it has been read. So they take it very seriously there, this whole idea of security. And again, to go back on the size, NSA uses the same amount of electricity that that the state capital does, Annapolis, the entire city of Annapolis does. One of the interesting things, and just a couple other statistics, they've got about 38,000 employees that work for NSA. Inside Crypto City, there's 32 miles of road. It has 17,000 parking spaces covering 325 acres. There's 37,000 cars registered in Crypto City. The post office delivers about 70,000 pieces of mail a day. The police force has about 700 uniformed officers. It has its own police force, Crypto City. About 700 uniformed officers, which puts NSA's police force in the top 4.8% of the nation's police forces. One of the things NSA produces a great deal of is paper. There was a congressional investigation at one point that, not a congressional, there was a hearing at one point where an NSA employee testified, and he testified that NSA produces somewhere between 50 and 100 million classified documents a year, which is more than all the rest of government combined. When all that is put on into paper, it's an enormous amount, and the way NSA handles it is you put it in burn bags when you finish it. These bags look like grocery bags and staple them. Put them in these chutes on the hallways, and the chutes drop down to conveyor belts all over the city, and they take these burn bags to a central location. It's to this big building known as the pulp plant, and they have this huge vat in there, and it looks like a huge vat of oatmeal, and that's the pulp, and they convert all this paper into pulp. And last year they sold a lot of that pulp to this company for $58,000, and the company takes the pulp and turns it into pizza boxes. So next time you order a Domino's pizza, if you take the pizza out and hold the box up to a bright light, you just might see what's left of a message from a North Korean general or something. So the NSA is a mammoth place with a lot of people in it that do extraordinary work. One of the things, and just to give you an idea of the people to some degree, NSA tries to keep the people very sociable. They like to keep the agency sort of like a family, more or less. So there's clubs everywhere in this, all kinds of clubs. And the idea is to try to get a lot of NSA employees to meet other NSA employees and marry other NSA employees. It cuts down on the clearance problems if two NSA employees meet. So you find an awful lot of NSA employees who are married to spouses who work for NSA, and then their children grow up and work for NSA. So they have a lot of clubs. One of the things they also have is, and one of the clubs, as a matter of fact, it sort of shocks a lot of the people who have retired a number of years ago, and when I tell them that it's this new club a couple of years ago called GLOBE, which stands for Gay or Lesbian or Bisexual Employees. And so they actually advertise in the GLOBE advertises in the NSA newsletter, and they hold their meetings in NSA offices, which is an enormous advance from a few years ago when it would have been certainly grounds for firing the employee, if not a firing squad for the employee. And they have they actually have their own film festival there, which is one that you'd never see anywhere else, especially in Hollywood. And last year's film festival, as a matter of fact, they had they have all these entries in their native language. They had one in the native Lap language. They had one in Wolof, which is spoken in Mauritania. One in Mora, which is spoken in Burkina Faso. They had one in Mongolian, and they actually have like a sort of a equivalent of like a Blockbusters there, where employees can rent these movies out in 48 different languages, all in their native language. So NSA has the largest collection of supercomputers in the world. It has the largest collection of linguists, at least in the United States. And in the building that houses the supercomputers is known as the Tordella Supercomputer Center. And it's a place where time is measured in femtoseconds, 1 million billionth of a second. And they're working on computers now that will do 1 septillion operations a second, which is one with 24 zeros after it. Because in order to break code, you need super, super fast, super powerful computers. The way NSA gets its raw material is by intercepting it as it goes through the air to a large degree. It has listening posts all around the world. And these are places that look like moon bases. An average listening post, such as the one in known as Menwith Hill Station in England, intercepts an average of about 2 million pieces of communications an hour. And that's faxes, telephone calls, email, data transfers, whatever. It just pulls it all in like a vacuum. And then they use supercomputers to sift through it and try to pick out the wheat from the chaff. They pull in so much information and make such heavy use of these computers that last February of 2000, all the computers at NSA totally crashed. It was one of the worst days in NSA's history. And they absolutely, every computer in the building crashed. Every computer in NSA crashed. They actually had to go to the British to have them help out because the satellites were still picking the information up, but there was nothing there to analyze the information. The computers were crashed, so they redirected a lot of it to England, and it took 4 days to get the computers back online again. That's one of the problems NSA has, is just so much information. Just want to see if there's anything else before I move on to September 11th. An idea of how they do the interception. A lot of it's done by satellite, for example. You put satellites in space and ground stations on the ground, you pick up a lot of the satellite communications. Satellite communications is what NSA focuses on largely. And that contains a lot of the commercial communications. So if you're going to call England or something, the odds are it's going to go up to a satellite and bounce down. So NSA will have these satellites out there, collect all the information, and put it through the computers. Another way is by collecting microwaves. If you see the little microwave towers around the city and around the country, out in the country in the wooded parts of the area, you see the towers with the little cones on them. Those are microwave antennas, and those are telephone calls being sent by microwave signals from tower to tower. A microwave travels in a straight line. It always just travels in a straight line, as opposed to high-frequency signals, which bounce off the ionosphere. But a microwave always travels in a straight line, which is advantageous if you're eavesdropping, because eventually that line continues, because the Earth is curved, that line continues out into deep space. So, for example, from Moscow to Vladivostok across Siberia, there's a whole line of microwave towers, which means that out in deep space, there's all these signals that are passing through, that are going from these towers, and they form like an arc. So if you put a satellite out there in geostationary orbit over the equator, and you focus on that area, you're actually eavesdropping on those communications. So that's sort of in a nutshell how NSA does a lot of the eavesdropping. I'll move on to September 11th. Given everything that I just said, and the size and the complexity and the power and the number of personnel, the logical question is, how is it that the NSA missed this September 11th? And it was an enormous intelligence failure. It's much worse than Pearl Harbor, because of Pearl Harbor, the U.S., prior to World War II, prior to Pearl Harbor, the U.S. had actually broken the Japanese high-level code, the Purple Code. They were reading the Japanese intercepted communications, and we were intercepting their signals in real time as they were sending them between Tokyo and the embassy in Washington. So they actually picked up the message, the 13-part message that basically indicated they were about to go to war. It was a message that said, at a certain time tomorrow, destroy all your crypto equipment. This is a message from Tokyo to the embassy in Washington. And destroy all your codes and crypto equipment. To anybody that reads that, you understand something bad's going to happen pretty soon. So they sent out a message to a lot of places around the world that something may happen. It got to Pearl Harbor a little late because they sent it by Western Union as opposed to using high frequency because of the atmospheric conditions. So you had this sad situation of this. I wrote about this in the Puzzle Pals, where after the smoke started dying down, the employee in the Western Union office took out the telegrams and went up to Pacific Fleet headquarters and handed the warning message to them. So a little late, but the difference is in Pearl Harbor, we had broken their high-level code, intercepted their communications, found out that they were about to have an attack someplace, and actually sent out warning messages. And none of those things took place on September 11th. None of the Al-Qaeda didn't really use many codes, but whatever codes they used, the NSA hadn't broken. They weren't intercepting Al-Qaeda communications in real time. There was no warning sent out, and as a result, the attack took place. At the time, at 9 o'clock in the morning, or you know, 8:45 when the attack started, the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, was in a restaurant having a leisurely breakfast in downtown Washington with an old friend of his. So you have this strange concept of couch potatoes across the United States lying on a couch or in bed watching TV and learning about the attack minutes before the director of Central Intelligence. So it was a total intelligence disaster. NSA is probably the most embarrassed of it all, because NSA is, like I said, is located halfway between Washington and Baltimore in this right outside this little bedroom community, NSA bedroom community of Laurel, Maryland. Well, the terrorist cell that took over the Flight 77 that crashed into the Pentagon, the place they picked for their to live and plan and do all their exercise and conduct their training, was Laurel, Maryland, literally in the shadow of NSA. And so you have this very strange irony of, on the morning of September 11th, the terrorists got in their cars at the Valencia Motel, took a right turn on Route 1 heading south towards Dulles Airport. At the same time, they were passing all the NSA employees in the other lane going north a few more miles to NSA's parking lots. So that morning, you had the actual terrorists coming within 2 or 3 feet of the people going to work to find the terrorists. So it was a real intelligence disaster. Now, the reason for this was because the NSA was designed for one purpose, basically. It was designed to focus on the Soviet Union and give early warning of a nuclear missile attack. And NSA did a very good job of that during the Cold War. It could tell immediately if a plane took off from some remote air base in Russia, NSA would know about it, or if a submarine pulled out of a pen, or if there was a... they decided on, instead of the normal Tuesday when they load up the missile silos with fuel, they did it on a Thursday this time. There'd be an alert throughout NSA because they would know about it. Well, the world changed when the Soviet Union ended and NSA became, Soviet Union became a third world country, basically, as far as the intelligence community was concerned. And all of a sudden, the attention was paid on all these crises that were breaking out. And NSA was not prepared to handle all these crises because it was loaded with Russian linguists who were no longer useful. The listening posts were all basically targeted to the Soviet Union. Everything was geared to the Cold War and the Soviet Union. So when U.S. troops went into Haiti, for example, NSA had a total of one Creole linguist. When we went into the Balkans, NSA had nobody that spoke Albanian, and very few people that spoke Serbo-Croatian. They had to scramble to find people that could speak it. So you got a problem of languages. When September 11th happened, there were less than five people that spoke Pashtun and Dari, the languages of Afghanistan. Languages are a real major problem. According to one of the senior person at NSA dealing with linguists, she said that said that the world has about 6,500 languages, and the number is increasing because as ethnic nationalism increases, there's more of a move to speak these sort of dying dialects to some degree. Out of the 6,500, NSA could handle about 115 of those. So languages is a key problem. The other another major problem is the swamp of information out there. If you think back 15 years ago, if you were going to send a piece of written communications, it would be in a letter or in a document form that would be sealed in an envelope and sent through the mail. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. People use the email, they use the internet, they use World Wide Web, they communicate electronically. So all that information that was once kept from NSA because of envelopes and postal systems is now available to NSA or anybody that has the technical capability to intercept signals going through the air. So NSA has all this additional information that's out there to go through. In addition, there are all the cell phones that are out there that weren't out there 15 years ago. So you've got this, and you know, just the influx of computers and so forth. So you've got this enormous amount of information out there that needs to be gone through if NSA is going to find this electronic needle in a haystack. So those are two of the problems: languages and influx of communications. Finally, I'll just say a little bit about how this incident took place and why they missed this specific incident. What NSA was geared up to do basically is watch for indicators of terrorist incidents. Those indicators are normally large. Well, they're basically about three of them. One is the movement around the world of known terrorists who are on watch lists and so forth. Another thing is the movement of large amounts of money to various suspicious people. And the third thing is the transfer of large amounts of explosives. In September 11, none of those things took place, basically. The people that came into the United States came in legally, they lived here legally. All but two of them, only two of that group, about 20, were, only two of that group were on any kind of a watch list. All the rest came in without being under any kind of suspicion. Finally, you've got the problem of the way they were communicating. They communicated in the form of cells, so they would just talk face-to-face with each other, basically. They did communicate occasionally by using the internet, but they would go to internet cafes and libraries, use anonymous computers and servers, and communicate using very innocuous messages, you know, equivalent of, remember Uncle Harry's birthday's next week, and the package is due to arrive on Monday or whatever, which, you know, if you're doing word spotting, you're not able to find. And you're not able to target those computers anyway because you don't know they're using them, and not able to target them because you don't know they even exist. So, and then finally, there was the problem of always looking outward when these people were actually living inward in the United States. So all those problems contributed to NSA's failure, and those are some of the things that, you know, are probably going to be on the agenda to correct. I worry a lot about these new procedures coming out of Washington, these new policies, especially creation of this new Office of Homeland Defense, which, according to the government today, or according to government officials, will be the second largest government agency in the entire country, second only to the Pentagon. This is one enormous agency. And I also wonder, it's one of the functions is supposed to be analysis of intelligence, and, you know, I thought that was what the CIA was supposed to be doing, but... in addition to that, this is supposed to be analyzing all the intelligence from all the different agencies to look for terrorism. But that's why they set up the Center for the National Center for Counterterrorism at CIA, to be an all-source analysis from all the different agencies. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions that have to be asked about all this this new reorganization what it's going to do, how much duplication, and one of the key questions is how much is it going to eavesdrop, or how much of this intelligence is going to begin focusing on U.S. citizens. There's a big problem of tearing down the firewall that was built up in the 1970s to separate the intelligence agencies from the American public, so it doesn't go back to creating the oppressive situation that existed in the 60s and 70s that led to a lot of illegal spying on U.S. citizens. So all these questions have to be asked. The president's speech was only 11 minutes and certainly didn't answer many of those questions. And